Girls. What? Keep it fresh. Dope Girls. Dope Girls.
Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast that spotlights some of the area's most interesting and accomplished women. Unify, reclaim, empower. Those are the goals of the Baltimore Transgender Alliance, which, in its own words, works to uplift the voices of transgender and gender nonconforming people in Baltimore City. Ava Pipitone serves as executive director of the Alliance, and she talked about the meaning of those goals and working to overwhelm mainstream narratives of trans people by telling their own stories. Founded in 2015 by Brianna Jenkins, the Baltimore Transgender Alliance is a coalition of organizations that has garnered attention for events like the Baltimore Trans Uprising protest. Ava, who's also a worker owner at Red Emma's Bookstore and Coffee House, is a Maryland native, and she talked a little bit about her childhood and the ways her extensive travels have shaped her. We also discussed the so-called trans tipping point, the Women's March on Washington, and the importance to Ava of observability. Here's our conversation. So tell me a little bit about yourself.
Oh, the open-ended question to start.
Okay. Yeah, that's a hard one.
Yeah, let me just give you the little blurb at the bottom of my Facebook profile.
Perfect.
I'm a trans woman from Baltimore City. I'm a worker owner at Red Emma's Coffee House and Bookstore, and I'm also the executive director of the Baltimore Transgender Alliance. So a catchy way of saying that is I stand up for my community and between you and your caffeine.
Yeah. Where did you grow up?
Actually, north of the city. My parents, believe it or not, lived on a farm, so horses, not crops or anything, but it's 30 minutes from where we are right now by car. So it's I went to school in Towson, so kind of county city, but it's in the city line. But I grew up in a very rural pocket next to like a winery north of Loch Raven Reservoir.
You know, I'm actually from Ohio, and I didn't know anyone who lived on a farm there, but everyone always like says like Ohio, and then when I came to Maryland, I met more people who were from farms than anywhere I ever had before.
Yeah, it's like a surprisingly agricultural state, despite like, I mean, we're all in the city now, and like I lived in New York for 5 years, and I lived in other cities and other countries, but I grew up on a farm.
You lived in other countries also?
Yeah, I went through like kind of a nomadic phase. Yeah.
Where were those?
Okay. I lived in Hawaii for like a quarter of a year, mostly outside, staying in different farms and different like communal living situations. And I lived in South Korea for a while, in Seoul, and 2 years in Kyoto in Japan, and then was nomadic for another 3-4 months, and then landed in New York again, New York City, before getting the job at Red Emma's in Baltimore.
What was growing up on the farm like?
I mean, let's get right to the chase. It was very gendered. So, I did a lot. So, like, being perceived as a dude growing up or being raised as a boy, I had to do a lot of manual labor and a lot of, like, I don't know, a lot of land to mow. It's really boring, but mowing grass, like, mucking out stalls for manure and stuff. A lot of physical, a lot of work. Like, our chores were a lot more than my friends' chores growing up. But I had 3 other siblings. And that was nice.
And was their work very gendered? Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, it was kind of like my 2 sisters, and they would be like studying the piano, and I was just like super jealous of that. And I would be like I said, mowing the lawn.
Was there any pressure or expectation in your family that you would grow up to farm also?
No. So my parents own a heating and air conditioning company. It's really successful. Pipco Heating and Air Conditioning, Pipitone Company. And there was, you know, to my dad's credit and my mom's credit, there was no expectation that we would kind of pick up the family business. There was like in the background conversations of what's going to happen to Pipco. But really, they spent a lot. They front loaded our education, like private elementary schools and private high schools. And I think that was intentional to kind of get us a better lot than they had. So because my grandparents were immigrants, so they kind of were social climbing still. Yeah.
What was your experience in school like?
I enjoyed school. Definitely in the moment, I really enjoyed things. I think looking back on my life, there's a lot of, like, now that I understand myself and I understand like who I've always been, right? I've always been a woman, and I've always been experiencing dysphoria at a low level and not being able to put my finger on it. So like, while I really enjoyed school and I actually had a lot of like wonderful connections and experiences throughout that, especially in high school, looking back, like I was doing what they call adopting the avatar. It's a thing where a trans person will, instead of exploring who they are and the connecting with their like identity or their gender identity, will just build an avatar of the gender they were assigned. And it's not really personal, but it's just like kind of robotic like persona that you just are. So like, I was like kind of this very like, in my concept of what a boy should be, I was just like very cut and dry, like captain of sports teams, straight A student, just this avatar of what a boy should be. And it was very, like I said, robotic. Yeah. But I mean, I wasn't aware I was doing that. So I was enjoying myself. I felt that I was successful and happy and fulfilled. But just every 4 years, I would feel like something is off. I don't know how familiar you are with what dysphoria is and how that manifests. But yeah, that's definitely what high school is.
Why do you think it was every 4 years, or why would it only crop up sometimes and not others?
So, yeah, again, like depending on what people's knowledge is of different terms, like I can get pretty jargon heavy when I talk about gender issues. But to give you an onboarding, when you have an understanding of yourself, like everyone has an understanding of their self. People use different language to describe it, like a neuromap or like a gender identity or like a sense of self. And if that doesn't match up with the like physicality that you find yourself in, there's a disharmony, and that's called dysphoria, right? And typically as a child, that's not something that's really going to grind you to a halt and force you to focus on it. It's just going to be low level in the background. But it does grow. It does pick up. And the common narrative is like 4 or 5 years. I don't know if this is to do with like hormonal cycles and like puberty and things, but it becomes overwhelming, and that overwhelming moment manifests in some kind of way, usually a depression of some kind. And then you get through it. You don't know what that was because our therapy doesn't really talk about it. And then, you know, you go on for another period of time, and then it comes back again. These gendery feelings, like I feel like I'm a girl. I don't know why. What's going on? Is this weird? Should I repress this? I definitely should repress this. Everybody says I should repress this. Okay, let's repress this. And you get through it, and then it comes back stronger and stronger. And what happens, in just from stories I've accumulated and things I've read, is like this: if you don't really engage with yourself, if you keep pushing yourself away and repressing, it builds up to like really negative energy. And then these like depressive episodes that cyclically keep returning in your life will ultimately grind your life to a halt in whatever way that happens.
How did you get yourself through those cycles of depression?
Yeah, right. So originally I would just kind of indulge. So, you know, I don't know if you want my like story, if that's what we're going for.
Sure.
Here.
Whatever you'd like
to
share.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty open about things. So like when I was little, there was like I was dressing up and playing like the girls club with my sister and didn't really think of that as unusual. Then I realized it was unusual. So I stopped indulging for a period of years. But then I came back again, and I just did it by myself because apparently it was weird to do it with other people. But then when I got to like middle school and high school, it wasn't like I wasn't able to actually like indulge in that side of myself because I went to like an all-boys school. So, and I'm not the only woman to have gone through that school. So I turned to art, and I would basically like paint my way through emotions a lot. And that was really successful. And I turned to athletics, and I was just processing my emotions with heavy weights, and you know, it allowed me to adopt that avatar I talked about already, and it allowed me to, you know, comprehend and process whatever emotional dissonance I was feeling. But those strategies didn't work when it came to college. College became a little bit more directly self-destructive to get through depression, and I was actually hospitalized at one point for different terms, right? Like they called it like a sudden, like a cute episode of hypermania. I'm like, what is that? So I didn't sleep for a couple of days, so I was really depressed, but you have a clinical term for it, okay? But what it was just really, really acute feelings of like this mismatch in my body. Very acute feelings. And I didn't know how to process it, so I was just going on internet tangents, reading people's stories, and I wasn't sleeping. And if you don't sleep for a couple of days, you kind of lose your mind. And then it went away, and I was on medication for a while for anti-anxiety stuff. I think just like run-of-the-mill, generic anti-anxiety medication. And sure, it helped me get back to even. And it helped me get my life back. And I graduated university with the presidential honors, whatever the higher GPA bracket is. And like I said, I went and traveled for a while. But while I was traveling, I had been in a four-year relationship, and I was living in Kyoto at the time and teaching English. Had plans, you know, with the person I was in a relationship with at that time to, you know, continue living together and take steps to start building a family. But the dysphoria came back right on cue at that four-year point. And at that point, I'd done a lot of self-reflection, especially after going through the more acute period in college and having to go through like medication and therapy. I'd been equipped with some more tools. And that was like, what is this? Like, let's look at some of these things that have been scaring me a little more seriously and know that I can get through them. And know that if I don't look at them, they're only going to keep getting worse. So I just went into researching what exactly transgender issues are. What does it mean to be transgender? And as I did that, as I looked at like every single checkbox from my childhood lined up with a really common narrative of what it means to be a trans woman. And as I accepted that and kind of came out to myself, it didn't like get any better. It just got a lot scarier because it's like, oh, great. I guess I'm going to have to, you know, start evaluating my life and possibly making changes to alleviate this dysphoria. And what's that going to look like? How are people going to accept this? And I have to come out to everyone. So, yeah, that was like, I don't know, 5 years ago at this point, 4 years ago, maybe. And I came out to myself and I just kind of decided that, you know, if there's ever a choice you make when you understand yourself as a trans person of whatever kind, that choice is to move through it and to live, right? That's the only choice. So I chose to live. And what that requires is to go in and make choices on your body, yourself, your expression. And those are all really hard. So I started that process and, you know, I started off seeing a gender therapist several years back. And I mean, here I am today and my body like is really in harmony with who I am. And I feel that my expression of myself and my ability to communicate with people is a lot higher, a lot more pure. And when I look back at all the connections I have lost, people that just couldn't handle it, you know, they had never seen me, I guess. Like, they'd only seen that avatar that I built. What the people who stayed with me through it, like from friends from high school, from friends from middle school, and friends from college, what they realized was whatever the external is doesn't really matter. And the connection that they had with me was not gendered. And that's a lot of mental processing for those people to have done. But people surprise you. And a lot of my friends have been able to, you know, accept me and move on and be happy for me and celebrate with me. And my family has too. So yeah, there's a lot of work on both sides, but I think it's all worth it. And yeah, I mean, that's like, and there's so many pieces that I can go into, but I want to kind of get to some other stuff. So that's like the overview of what I've been through. But I mean, that's like glossing over all the really good stuff while being trans and like the actual living of that trans experience in Baltimore City, which I want to talk about too.
Do you remember the first trans person you met or were aware of?
Oh yeah, sure. Well, I encountered trans people in New York. I lived in New York for 5 years, and I was out as kind of queer. So like my sexuality was queer. My gender identity was just like, I wasn't concerned with it because I didn't know that that was a problem yet. So I'm living in New York City in college and see lots of gender queerdos, lots of like agender, non-binary people, a lot of punks, and a lot of trans women, especially. But then I really encountered gender variance when I left the West. Like when I left the United States and Europe. When I was in Asia Pacific, Southeast Asia. Like a lot of like understandings of gender that were not binary, and I was really cueing into it. Like, especially after I left Kyoto and was wandering for like 4 months, I went through, like, I remember encountering Hijra in Mumbai, and that form of like kind of what a trans woman is, but very, very different. Encountered Kathoe in Thailand, in Indonesia, like, you know, there was 5 different genders. So just like understanding that gender is more complex, and I was tuning into all these things after I'd come out to myself as trans, and I'm like, oh, so this binary that I've been like living inside of is not real. Well, where'd it come from in the United States? What is this like binary? And then, you know, I go into like understanding what that is, like capitalism and like how whiteness and the binary are connected and how this is all like made up.
So you obviously led by introducing yourself as a trans woman and leading with that. Have you always been so open, and is that an integral part of your identity?
Yeah. So when I came into myself as being trans, when I came out to myself, there was a lot of language still floating around that was constantly changing. And I think that was during like the trans tipping point, whatever, which I had no idea was going on. I came back to the United States and I'm like ready to come out to my family as this thing that no one's ever heard of. And then it's like all over TV. And I'm like, wait, I've been tuned out of like United States media for a while. And now like you're all talking about trans stuff and I'm coming back and saying I'm trans. Like, what? Like, so like it's all in the moment of like language is changing and specifically like passing. I don't like that. I'm not trying to pass for a cis person. No, trans is beautiful. I'm trying to assert that beauty and that value. So whatever, I'm not trying to like be cis. I'm trying to be trans and I'm trying to let everybody know that I'm trans, but I'm trying to be in control of that knowledge. So what I say is, how observable are you? Right? I can, like in the beginning of my transition, I was very observable. Like I had lots of facial hair. My voice was really different. And like my body was just fat, was all in the wrong places. And like I was very like male coded gender signals when you observe me. So my transness was very observable. But now as hormones have done their thing over the last few years and I've kind of changed my mannerisms and idiosyncrasies and whatnot, I'm a little less observable. I don't say that I pass. I say that I have access. And I think it's really important to be trans while having that access, to be trans while not being observable. So I introduced myself as a trans woman because I've had access to get to that point at which I can introduce myself. So it's like when I'm waiting in line, no, I'm not really drawing much attention. I'm just another woman in line. But when I get to the register and it's one-on-one with that cashier, then they know that I'm trans and I'm very pleasant and we go on and they're like, oh, okay, so trans people aren't all those stereotypes that I've been hearing.
I wanted to kind of talk about that trans tipping point that you mentioned and just like visibility in Western pop culture has increased exponentially, it seems, with, you know, sometimes with people who are universally praised and beloved, maybe like Janet Mock, sometimes with people like Caitlyn Jenner, who are the object of a lot of criticism from both sides. I mean, what has your experience been like with this increased prevalence of trans people in pop culture and how important is visibility?
Yeah, look at all the trans people you just named and like how pretty are they? And they're all women. So I think people assume that visibility has increased, but like pretty people have always been visible. Women, pretty women have always been visible. That's okay. You're just finally including a little bit of transness in it. Okay, hooray. But no one's talking about like trans masculine issues and trans men and like there are issues with suicide and with sexual violence. And no one's talking about like genderqueer issues. And I think, like, yes, there was trans tipping point, but it was very much, like, you can't disentangle it from privilege. And pretty privilege, white privilege, yeah, those people got a lot of attention. But aren't pretty white people already getting a lot of attention? So I feel like, yes, there was this trans tipping point, but it was only the most digestible of trans people. It was only the most cis-normative trans people. So it's still, like, there's still, like, as a culture, as a society, we still have a lot of internalized transphobia, and that will be cool with trans people as long as they look a certain way. We're not really cool with trans people, like, as they are, or as we are. And that's still like, a thing that we're fighting for, which is why it's important for me to introduce myself as a trans woman, because I need you to know that, like, we're everywhere. and all of us, no matter how, like, observable we are valuable.
And that's been an issue within the LGBT community also. It's a lot of rights are still centered around the rights of white gay men, right?
Right. And, you know, the whole marriage equality in Maryland. I don't know if I need to go into that or not, but marriage equality basically dropped trans issues to get through. And that's the thing. Like, that's respectability politics. You can't really... People label trans and this variance of gender and this expansion of gender as like less respectable. And then they look at things we do because of societal oppression, because of the various intersections that manifest in certain of our bodies that kind of force us into certain lines of work. They look at all these things as not respectable. And then they drop our cause because they don't understand that we're all connected. And they think that, well, if we're fighting for gay marriage, if we're fighting for gay male rights, we can't really also be allies or be accomplices or support this trans issue because it's going to hold us back. And what that is missing is the whole, you know, a slight to one is a slight to everyone. The whole, like, our issues are all interwoven, and my freedom is necessarily contingent upon yours. And that's that, like, basic intersectional analysis is lacking in a lot of LGBT activism. I think it's coming up a lot. So it's like a big buzzword now, which is great. Okay, say the buzzword, but also do it. You know, I think there's lots of good examples we can point to where people are being inclusive, and there's lots of good LGBT activism that is reflecting and improving on the mistakes of the past.
How did you get involved in activism, and how did you get involved with the Baltimore Transgender Alliance?
Right. So I, like I said, I was a wandering for a while, and then I came back to Baltimore specifically because I knew Red Emma's was here. And I was interested in Red Emma's because a good friend of mine, his name is Sean, he told me about the transgender section in the bookstore at Red Emma's. And I went into that section, and I had never seen a transgender section. So I bought, like, all the books and read, like, all the books, and I haven't, like, left that section, and now I'm, like, a part owner of that section of the store. So that really, like, magnetically pulled me. I found myself in those, the literature there and the information there. And as I plugged into what that space was and what a work cooperative could be and how we demonstrated a lot of the politic that had been talked about or is being talked about, and Red Emma's as a viable demonstration of an alternative, a viable demonstration of, like, self-empowerment and kind of a way in which, like, marginalized voices can be heard and can be lifted up and honored in a space. Like, I kind of fell in love. I kind of drank the Kool-Aid in a sense. Like, when I was there, I just wanted to be as much of a sponge. And I think people who knew me when I first started working there, first started hanging out, see me now, they could, you know, most improved player award. I don't know. I think I've been a sponge over the years. And during that time, I think like a year in or so, like half a year in, I don't know, I met Brianna Jenkins, the founder of the Trans Alliance, and Monica Yorkman, founder of Sisters of the Tea. And they were having meetings at Chase Brexton. I don't know, I'm kind of an internet person, and I think I found out about their meeting electronically, and you could drop in. So I went to hang out a couple times, and then after coming and starting to, like, just listen and offer whatever I could, you know, they gave me more and more responsibility. And this was, like, before Trans Alliance was a thing. It was kind of the conversation after a Sisters of the Tea meeting was about a little more of a political thing and less of a support group thing. And as I stayed around and started participating in that, it became, like, this Trans Alliance thing. And then I was devoting all my time to it. And then we, you know, had the Trans Uprising, and then we had the Trans March of Resilience. And then we understood that there was a craving in the city for this trans autonomous project that wasn't under the umbrella of a larger LGBT organization, that was independent and was a sanctuary space. And then as I started getting more and more into it and feeling the potential and feeling the need for this project, Brianna made the move to law school in Chicago, which is great. We need trans lawyers. But then it's like, well, who's going to lead this? And then she, you know, all the times me and Brianna had been hanging out and she'd be introducing me to all these different leaders throughout the country, I understood that she had been grooming me.
And you didn't know it all along.
Not really. I kind of tuned in like later on. But then she's like, all right, you know, Ava, this is going to be your thing when I leave. And I'm like, wait, what? And I started like giving the speeches at some of the events, and then she left, and then I just have been figuring it out. I think this whole time, like, I haven't said much about what the Alliance is, so maybe I should, like, give a little elevator pitch while we're here, just
sure,
for people who aren't familiar. So we are an alliance of trans-led organizations. So it's a coalition of the leaders of trans-led organizations in Baltimore City, and we can act together for three main reasons. The buzzwords would be unify, reclaim, and empower. What we're doing is we're unifying Baltimore's transgender communities. There are many different communities, and there's lots of isolation, just like there's isolation in Baltimore City amongst the population at large. And we need to collectively come together so we can collectively heal. And we need to have a trans autonomous space to do that. When we talk about reclaiming, what we are doing is pushing back against that narrative, but all too often morbid narrative that you encounter in mainstream media of trans murders and suicides. And we're overwhelming that narrative with trans artists and creators, educators, mothers and fathers, parents, thriving, contributing trans people. And we're reclaiming our story and recentering it on our actual stories, our actual lives, because trans people are thriving in Baltimore. And just because some of us are dying as well, that's not the story. The story is our lives, and the story needs to be recentered on our lives, on our contributions, and on our projects.
Well, it's an important story, yeah. Right? But yeah. Both stories are important.
Both That's stories what it seems. Are, but the first thing that people think when they think trans is they think devalue and they think sad and morbid. And we need to push back against that because you've probably given us coffee before. You probably sat next to us on the bus before, you know, and there's stories there and we need to share that. And the last one is empowerment. Trans people need to empower ourselves because only we know how to do that. And we can't, people understand. They look at us and they identify issues in our community. Oh, HIV is prevalent in the trans feminine community, especially in POC communities. And they like design an HIV thing and keep pushing it on us. And we're like, but we're not asking for that. We're asking for housing. We've been asking for housing and you've been pushing out this other thing. So we don't trust you. We need to empower ourselves, right? And we need to be trusted to take care of ourselves and to know what we need. And we need to be trusted to talk on our own issues and not be criteriaed or credentialed out of speaking on our own issues, which has been the history. So that's really the Alliance came together for those three reasons. And what that looks like is when we have our march in November or when there's a trial happening or when there is a piece of legislation happening, we can call everyone together. We can call the leaders from Black Trans Men Inc. and Black Trans Advocacy and Sisters of the T. We can call on the people over at Trans Ladies Picnic, and everybody can get in the same room and talk and act together. And that's powerful.
You mentioned there are so many wonderful things about being trans in Baltimore. What has your experience been here like?
Wonderful things about being trans in Baltimore. I mean, I live in that queer bubble. Right, I came out in that space of radical, like radically inclusive space of like anarcho-feminist thought and like people doing this like, you know, this post-colonial like artistic expression of like trying to like redefine. And I was in that bubble, right? And that's wonderful. That's a euphoric space when I go to different house music scene, DJ parties, when I go to the different things all over the station, North Greenmount West community that are like that my friends are putting on, I feel like safe. I thrive, right? So that's wonderful. But also like being trans in Baltimore, I think there's a big connection. There's a lot of history here. And I feel that I'm becoming part of that. Like people don't, well, I mean, our history is actively erased, so definitely people don't know. But there, Baltimore City has been kind of a trans, like coming together, a point of trans community for a long time in the country. The what we know as Paper Moon Diner over in Remington, Charles Village area, that was called Open Door Diner. It used to be the trans women hangout, 24-hour diner that women would hang out in and then go out tricking or not. And like the stroll used to be all the way downtown, all the way up to where it is now. I think pushing the stroll up out of Mount Vernon was a relatively recent development. So like transgender people that engage in like survival or street level sex work usually do that on like a certain area. You call it the stroll, right? And that, I mean, we've been here forever. We've been here forever and we're going to be here forever because that is part of like our community and this, like whether it's survival or whether it's thriving, like, I mean, people try to actively erase us or like label us as like the, I don't know, the trash or whatever of like their neighborhood. But what they don't understand is we were here before you and we're going to be here after you. And I don't care what you say on next door, like we're going to be here. Yeah, I don't know. What's it like being trans? It's connected. And right now, especially like our community of like queer and weirdos is thriving. Like in that radical, like honestly, in that queer, trans, white Facebook community, that community is like exponentially expanding. And what's happening now is when you look at like POC trans communities too, like when you look at like Girls United, like props to them, they are growing. They are like having massive balls and social gatherings that are just more and more young trans women are coming out. And then you look at Trans Baltimore and Kieja's doing at the GLCCB and she's got tons of different women that coming every other week on to it's a support group, but it's like it seems to be coming more than that. Like all of these communities are growing right now. And to be a part of that, I feel like there's this energy in Baltimore along gender expansive identities, and the Alliance is uniquely positioned because like yeah, my title is executive director, but the Alliance is really, it functions more of a collective, a horizontal platform for all these communities to come together and then act together, like I was saying earlier. So I feel that this is happening. We're building our spaces. And, you know, as the current regime change in this country happens and we get this pressure from legislation, this pressure from rulers, and this pressure from transphobic society generally pushing on us, we are building very strong sanctuary spaces, and we are pushing back out and holding our bubble and holding our space and asserting ourselves as part of the city in a beautiful way.
On that note, the Baltimore Transgender Alliance attended the Women's March, right?
Yeah.
What was your experience there like?
Okay. Well, you go to a march like that, and you know. I don't want to give, it was great, or, it was awful, because there were bits and pieces of all that. But you go there and you know, everybody is, I'm not going to encounter a bunch of allies at the Women's March. I know that going in. So, and I'm personally thinking, this is this white liberal thing happening. I don't really understand why people want to go. But, so many trans women and gender expansive and trans men were contacting me saying that they wanted to go. Is Trans Alliance organizing a bus? So I had to put on my Trans Alliance hat. And be, despite my own views, people are going to this. So I have an obligation to get my trans family there and back safely. And knowing that it's not all going to be friends, I have to also organize in such a way that we would be around friends. And people who are more sensitive and are more vulnerable in their expression and their identity is a little newer, maybe. I need to be able to kind of provide a safe space for that. So I get this kind of mothering instinct over the group. And we organized it and we went down there. And we met up with more trans groups intentionally, to be around friends. But it doesn't really protect you from these very binary, very genital essentialist imagery. And that's all there. Okay, people understand women to be pink, so I guess only white people. Pink and vagina, so I guess only cis white people count as women. Not all vaginas are pink, and not all women have vaginas. So if you want to talk about women from a genital perspective, you should show the diversity of genital configuration that make up what a woman is. Why is that not obvious? I don't know. Capitalism. But yeah, of course, we encountered those things that were excluding us. But we showed up and asserted ourselves. So, I mean, I was very much ready for all those problematic aspects. I went down expecting that, and I found all that, but I also found this large community of liberal energy moving in a direction that I saw as potential. I saw that as, we talk about the radicalization of liberals, the radicalization of the left. I think this is an opportunity. I mean, the Women's March had an end point, but I didn't even notice when we had passed that end point. We had kept marching for 6 or 7 blocks before people realized we were off the route and still going. And there were still kids, and there were still people with the pink hats on that didn't show up for a critical mass march to shut down infrastructure of the city. They showed up for a parade. And after that liberal parade ended, there was a continuation. A continuation because there is so much energy that the predefined route for that parade was not enough to contain it. So I see that as potential. So my experience at the Women's March was that there is potential for people that are of a more reformist perspective to maybe think about their role in democracy in this country and maybe understand that they are interlocked with our oppression and maybe understand that they won't feel that women are being respected and they can't combat sexism without combating trans sexism and trans misogyny and transphobia. It's all intertwined, and they kept marching with us, so maybe they do realize that. Maybe I'm too optimistic.
What are some challenges that trans communities face that are specific to Baltimore?
History. I mean, Baltimore is a primarily black city, 60%, and what you find is I'm a white person, so I'm not the best to talk on this, but what you find people navigating and conforming to the binary more in black trans communities, and I think that there's a lot to be said about that. When you experience more violence based on this internalized idea of gender binary, it's a colonial idea, but it's really deeply internalized in certain communities, especially the black community in Baltimore. And I think navigating that binary is much more of a safety issue for some people. I'm very privileged in my whiteness, and I can, or that my, you know, And I'm very, I'm able to be a little bit gender nonconforming in some aspects, or I was, especially in the beginning of my transition, and I was safe or safer. But I mean, for other people, it's like you're observed and you're hurt. You're not observable and you're safe. Yeah, I don't know if that's like a tangent or not. But you said, like, what are the challenges of being trans in Baltimore?
Well, yeah, that are specific to Baltimore, maybe beyond the challenges that all trans communities face.
Yeah, I think then I guess we can talk more legislative issues. For example, Baltimore is still in the Stone Age when it comes to bathroom policies. Like, in restaurants, you can't have gender-neutral bathrooms in Maryland. I mean, yes, we have protections, which is great. Like, we can, you know, you can go wherever you identify, and that's great. You can get a carry letter in Baltimore if you don't have your gender marker changed on your ID. Okay, cool. But you don't actually need one. There's no gender police in the bathrooms. But if you are a restaurant owner and you want to put a gender-neutral bathroom in, you're going to be in an uphill battle. I read Emma's, they literally bring the gender signs and make sure we have them when the inspectors come.
And then at Red Emma's, you guys usually tape a sign that says you can go in wherever you want.
And I mean, our clientele is specific and is politically motivated and often tears off all the signs. So even if we put gender signs on to conform with the health inspection, then like our patrons tear off the signs. So then we have paper signs because they're more easily replaced. So it's like Maryland doesn't want this legislation, but I don't understand. Even if you have single stall bathrooms, you still need them to be marked with genders. And I think just certain scales, certain size businesses can get away with a little more, which is why you'll see some cafes with like some funny, some really beautiful markers on the bathrooms, like alien and human. But not everybody can get away with that, especially if you're known in the city to be a little bit more pushing the envelope. You get more of an inspection. But there's so much more. There's a lot to do with prosecution of people, repeat offenders of sexual violence, and how that manifests in the trans community, especially in like the realm of sex work. There's still some issues. There's some legislation being pushed early on in the session right now about that. I'm not the best to talk on it, but I would always point you towards Black Trans Advocacy to talk a little more about that. My friend Merrick Moses over there, they're doing really good work trying to push this legislation through that allows us to prosecute repeat offenders. But I was just at the trial for Mia Henderson, and to hear someone from the public defender's office just using absolutely horrifying transphobic language against a murder victim, just like intentionally misgendering, intentionally calling her like a man, and like using her dead name actively as much as she could, even though like Mia had been Mia for like 18 years. Why would be using a legal name? Why would that? It doesn't make any sense. Why that would be like, is she trying to communicate more effectively? I don't know. No, her name was Mia. And she had been a woman for over a decade. Like, there's no legally relevant way to do that. But then talking about, like, choices around her body and, like, surgical choices or not surgical choices is so irrelevant to a case. But said prosecuting attorney, or defense attorney, sorry, knew that the jury is loaded with layers of social bias. So when you can get away with transphobic language and transphobic attacks, the jury will be affected whether or not there's like a judge could, you know, check your speech. What really scares me is, say that same defense attorney has to defend me because they're a public defender and I can't afford a lawyer. Say they have to defend me and they hold those views. Are they going to do a good job? If they think I'm like some kind of weird monster, they think I'm like some kind of like dude who mutilated himself or what? Like, I don't want them anywhere near me, let alone defending me. So I think there's a giant lack in training and competency, not only in that Office of Public Defenders, who we have friends there. I hope they're listening. I hope they know. Time for a competency training. Talk to John Michelle. Talk to the people over there. Also, I mean, it's deeper. It's hopefully the language in the consent decree gets through. I met with the DOJ along with other people at Trans Alliance. The lead investigator, Earl Saunders, was very directly communicating with us, meeting with us frequently about what language needed to be in there, and we made sure language... language along being respectful to trans people, transporting trans people in gender-appropriate transportation, and also housing us in gender-appropriate facilities or giving us options. Like, that language is in there as the consent decree stands right now. Let's see how our friend, forget the name of the federal judge who's going to be approving it or editing it. Let's hope it all gets through. But remember, that's future language. So right now, the language is not there. And right now, the ability for officers to intentionally, like, harass you is there. Right now, the reality is officers will like harass you, misgender you, and then store you in the wrong facility or the wrong holding intentionally to make it hard on you, to punish you. And that's evil. That's so evil.
Are you surprised you have become an activist and an organizer? Would you ever have expected that of yourself earlier?
I don't know. I don't know. Is it useful to be retrospective like that? I am doing the things I'm doing. So like the trajectory that got me here, I don't know if it's necessarily relevant, but I do catch myself thinking about it sometimes. I think when I was little, my grandma always used to say that I was an overachiever. Like, Ava, you're an overachiever. You're like always doing this and that. And I didn't really know what that meant. I think I have that weird personality that lends itself to the type of work. Like, I'm just naturally extroverted. I can't not be. And I don't mind making decisions that are in leadership roles. I think that what is the biggest part is that I'm a Libra and I'm very balancing and equivocating, yes. I have some trouble making decisions, yes, but that's good sometimes. But really, I'm good at balancing people who disagree. So especially in the Alliance, amongst the leadership team or amongst other leaders and other organizations, bringing people to some kind of consensus is something that maybe I can do or have a proclivity towards. So I think that it makes sense that I'm in that role. I don't necessarily feel like it's work. I feel like it's just what I like to do anyhow. So I'm just applying myself. So I don't know. Maybe it does make sense that I'm doing what I'm doing, but I don't know how. There's so many things that got me to where I am right now. I don't know how I became like such a figure in this movement so quickly. I don't know how that happened, but hi.
But it did. Yeah. So what's next for you and for the Alliance?
Yeah. So we're in the happy, wonderful land of writing grants. We are doing all the grant applications for all the bigger chunks of cash, which are necessary to do what we really want to do. When we talk about empowering ourselves, what we mean is, like I said, sanctuaries and sanctuary spaces. The ideal manifestation of that is some kind of transitional housing project that trans people run and operate ourselves for ourselves. And what's really tricky here is, like, so many organizations are better equipped to do that than we are. But like I said, criteria, credentials are not what we're dealing with. We need to have our own space and we need to build it and do it ourselves. And if you think you're helping us by doing it for us, you're hurting us. So what's next for the Alliance is we're going to house ourselves and we're going to continue nurturing and strengthening these sanctuaries we've already built.
Ava, thanks for coming in today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Ava Pipitone. Female Trouble is back every Tuesday, and you can find it on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or anywhere else you listen to podcasts. We're also on Twitter at FMLTrouble and online at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble. If there's someone you'd like to see featured on the podcast, you can send me an email at qkelly@baltsun.com. And that's QKELLEY at baltsun.com. Past podcast guest TT the Artist is featured in our theme song, which is called Dope Girls by Shifty. Thanks again, and we'll be back next week.